Can a car connect the world inside with the world outside? The 2019 Lincoln MKC with Lincoln Connect 4G LTE Wi-Fi allows 10 devices to connect at once. Learn more at lincoln.com/MKC. Don't drive distracted or while using handheld devices. Use voice controls.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast. Is that me? You just write that now? Of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Maybe it's time to let the old ways die. Maybe it's time to let the old ways die. It takes a lot to change a man. Hell, it takes a lot to try. Maybe it's time to let the old ways die.
Watch as I dive in. Oh. A star been born, to be totally frank. I feel like we're coming in after the fact. That was Maybe It's Time. And one thing has been clear over the last few weeks, which is that maybe it's time that Popcast weighs in on A Star Is Born. That's an emphatic yes. This is going to be a rowdy one. We're turning people away for this week's episode.
The table is full.
Literally, table is full. We got calls coming in. There's a line outside the door. There's multiple people who've written pieces about A Star Is Born who work for this enterprise who are not in this room right now. I'm sorry to those people. But literally, if I'm going to have to travel with one road crew, this is the road crew I want to go with.
Aww.
The gang is here. It's Joe Coscarelli.
Mm-hmm. The Sam Elliott of the road crew.
Wow. Yeah. But yeah, I need you to shave your beard, though.
Yes, soon.
Wesley Morris.
I'm the Andrew Dice Clay of this operation.
Wow.
I'm going to claim a spot.
That's good. That's good. I got hairstyle pretty similar.
A little fade.
Pretty similar. John Perales is here.
Does that make me Lorenzo? I think I want to withdraw from this role playing.
You want to opt out? You wish to be removed from this narrative? And you know we couldn't do A Star Is Born, the Popcast, without Karen the Gans.
The Shangela of Popcast, I
obviously.
Think.
Yeah. Wait, but literally, who does this make me? Now I'm like, am I Jackson Maine?
You are Jackson Maine.
Oh, my
God.
And in every particular.
Will you guys excuse me for a
second? Oh, Jackson's down.
He always does that.
Oh, man.
I think you're a Jackson Maine Alley Rising.
Is this podcast on? Is this podcast on? Okay.
We might have an injury.
Woo!
Early injury.
So before we really get into it, I just want to put an open call out for anyone who's familiar with whatever hair products that Bradley Cooper, a.k.a. Jackson Maine, was using in A Star Is Born. I would be interested to know about those hair products.
I feel like everybody has a thing they want to incorporate into their personal lives from this movie, which, I mean, when we talk about, we're going to talk about the Streisand version, but this is something that was true of that version of this movie too, where there were just
part of it.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to just quickly go around the table because there are very, very differing and valid opinions about this film in the world. And so let's start with Karen Gans because no person put more pressure on me to have a certain set of feelings about this movie than my editor, Karen. Hi, Karen.
I didn't pressure.
Should I read the texts?
We're going to FOIA the text messages.
All right. There might have been some text.
So
she said, if you like it, you're fired.
Oh, this is
going to
be
my last Popcast. I want to thank everybody for their support. Karen, how'd you feel about A Star Is Born, number 4?
I did not like the movie.
Mm-hmm.
However.
No. Stay with that feeling.
No. I'm still with that feeling.
Yeah.
I did like Lady Gaga. Mm-hmm. And I was expecting to have the reverse feelings. Mm-hmm. I thought that I was going to think that she was terrible and think that the movie was fine.
Can you talk about the ways in which the movie failed for you?
Oh, God. I mean, there's so many.
Just pick 2.
It was so long.
That is accurate.
It was really long.
That is accurate.
They're all long.
It was long and also
you can't make one without it being 3 hours.
But also, like, it was long and, like, maybe weirdly not long enough. Not in the quality sense, but in the y'all left out, like, 7 explanatory.
There's definitely a lot of deleted scenes, like Dave Chappelle's entire character.
Yeah. There's a lot that was left unexplained, yes. Including, I would argue, the relationship between Allie and Jackson. It was very hard to understand what it was that they actually saw in each other.
You know that falling in love is the only part of a relationship that matters.
Oh.
For the first 20 minutes. And I liked the first 20 minutes of the movie, and then it took a turn. The other thing that I'm sure we're going to talk about, but I have a huge issue with, which John wrote so elegantly about yesterday, was how the movie treats pop music versus rock music.
Oh, man.
Which was very problematic for me because it seemed to say that pop music is meaningless and devoid of any authenticity and cannot possibly be invested with any durability or real emotions or a point or a politics of itself or any sort of philosophy. But rock music, which we all know is wildly popular right now, rock music is the enduring one. That's the one that matters.
Karen, I want to tell you that...
oh my God!
I took your voice.
No, John. John, this is not a safe zone for this.
You didn't have anything.
My pants are really tight today. Don't do that in here.
And
don't do
that. And also, for the record, you guys all know I like rock music, and that. So this, if I am saying
and
this, we have
show.
A problem.
That was great. It only took what 4 minutes.
I did not bring a guitar.
To the defense of rock music.
I didn't bring a guitar, but I wore a Barbara Streisand shirt because something had to. Something had to happen here today.
Okay, JP, I know you wrote the piece about pop music and authenticity. Oh, my God. I feel like I've been afflicted with authenticity. But what did you think of the film as a film, separate of the concerns of pop music authenticity?
I kind of felt it jerking my tears. I really felt the mechanisms of it going on.
Sure.
And we saw it in a great theater with a big screen up close, really loud. And the close-ups were making me incredibly claustrophobic.
Yeah, sounds abusive.
I mean, it was really...
Those speakers were banging.
Yeah, it was like back off people.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I should say that JP, Joe, and Karen saw it at a screening.
Together.
Together.
At a real
movie
theater.
I was able to go, and I paid $19 to see it at Union Square Cinema.
We'll see those in your expenses when you file them in 8 months or
yes,
so.
That's correct. Shout out to the plug.
But anyway,
my reimburser.
But the thing that got me was, what year is this?
Yeah.
It's like Kris Kristofferson still starring in this movie?
I want to get back to that because that's a very valid question. One of many I was left with. Wesley Morris. Standalone, number four, what'd you think? We'll get to the previous ones later.
I love the first hour of this movie.
Yeah.
Hour?
The first hour of this movie is just...
Chef's kiss.
It's just, it's breathtaking. And part of what's breathtaking for me is I actually accept this movie not as a movie about the pop music making machine because if when looked at that way and we can do that because I can think of very few better people to do that with than you guys, but I actually thought of this as a musical. I thought of it as a classical musical that happens to be about people who perform for a living. And while I do not I philosophically and spiritually object to the abuse of the term musical as applied to movies about performers. In this case, it's a weird, I'm not legally defending this movie by calling it a musical. I just felt like there are so many things that don't make any real sense.
If you don't consider it through those terms.
So there has to be a kind of surrender that you either willingly do or wind up doing. And for me, my surrender was, oh, I'm watching a musical.
Also, and just to that point, and actually we were earlier when we were upstairs, we were sort of debating this film's relationship to like musical theater and whatnot. But a point in the favor of that is that a lot of the songs are not explicitly narrative, but they're quasi-narrative. They're narrative. They're about what's happening.
Yes.
And like they kind of slip in and out of like, this is what's happening. And I'm singing about the thing that is happening. They're kind of like slip in and out of positionality, but they are in essence narrative drivers.
They're the emotional plot points.
Right. Exactly. But it's hard. I think that the reason the first hour is so great is that the songs aren't really required to be a plot engine.
Well, there's acting in the first hour.
Well, also, okay. So in the second hour, everything that's wonderful about the first hour changes. And what you're watching for the first hour, basically, is two people fall in something like love. And it's not romantic love. I also, which is what I also think is great about this movie, is I don't believe these two people are in a kind of sexual love. I think that, I mean, I know that's what we're supposed to believe, but if you saw Barbra Streisand and Kris Kristofferson fall in love with each other, Bradley Cooper's brain is in love with Lady Gaga's persona.
Yeah, like the come on line in the parking lot, I think we got a songwriter here. Can you imagine like a first Tinder date, and at the end of the Tinder date, you're like, I think we got an accountant here. You know, like,
look, this is a very long Tinder date. I mean, she punches an officer of the law.
Yeah, there are a lot of unresolved legal things in this film.
I'm accepting it as a musical, if Beyonce were starring in this movie, which
we're gonna get there.
Yeah, yeah.
What happens in then, that scene?
Yes.
You know, he doesn't bring her to a cop bar in the first race, place.
Right. The racial meta narratives. Okay, we're going to come back. But okay, we're going to come
first
back.
First hour, really good. Second hour, not nearly as good.
Joe Coscarelli.
I loved it. I loved it. It's a
You hid this from me for days.
I did not. I told you when we left the theater. Like
everybody fired.
The more I've thought about it, the more I just, it's a capital M movie. It's just it's a blockbuster for adults that is not about superheroes.
Are you reading this off the poster?
This sounds like Manola's review.
Look, the poster told no lies. It's so imperfect. It's a mess, but it's not a mess in a bad way. It's a mess in a fun way. John, you watched it. You don't even watch movies.
I know.
It's so true. Watchable. Exactly. The cinematography was great. Mm-hmm. The chemistry was great.
He's a filmmaker.
The supporting performances, I thought, really hold it together. I would watch a whole movie about the livery drivers, the dad and his crew.
Mm-hmm.
I thought
spinoff.
The slimy manager guy, you know, and then the music industry stuff, right? Like, this is what we are music writers. Mm-hmm. We're obsessed with the industry. The Grammys, hilarious. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Halsey.
Wait, here's a question. Best supporting actress. Who was the dude who was like the fake Quavo who was sitting behind
us? Yes, I saw that.
There was definitely
like
a fake Quavo.
Yes, I was like, is it Quavo?
Yeah, I know.
It's fake Quavo.
In the same way where I was like, is it Halsey? And it was. I was like, is it Quavo? But it wasn't.
Who was supposed to be doing the tribute?
Oh, the guy.
Ed Sheeran.
Oh, I was going to say more like a Tom O'Dell type.
Yeah.
I got pure Sheeran vibes.
I got Sheeran. Yeah, that's where my
but
brain
he's
went.
That guy was really elongated.
Yeah. No, I mean not I mean
he
couldn't...
was very rockabilly in body, but in terms of the thing he was representing,
like
in the,
Justin yeah. Towns Earl.
Yeah, but instead of, you know, that cuz that's the Gary Clark Jr. segment of the Grammys that happens every year, but you know, then the pop star comes in, you know, a little bit of Shawn Mendes in there.
Yeah,
it was the pop guy. But then the SNL, you know, the Alec Baldwin season finale of SNL. It's like the real life details are hilarious. The memeability, you know, is obviously off the charts and is not annoying somehow yet. You know, it will be by the time the Oscars roll around. Mm-hmm. But I love that there's something basically about the music industry, but that is something we can just enjoy without having to dive too far in. You know, it's a fairy tale. And yet we're gonna pick it apart. And I love picking it apart.
Speaking of memeability, if A Star Is Born does win two Oscars and Bradley Cooper does go on stage two times, he's definitely gonna say the second time, I just wanted to take another look at it.
Wow. All right, you're banned from quoting him for the rest of the podcast. I can't take it.
But that's a tagline from all of them.
And he will say it in honor of Kris Kristofferson and all the other old white men. Okay, so from an opinion perspective, I agree with Wesley. I found the first hour, like, captivating and, like, completely transfixing and, like, lushly erotic from a visual perspective.
It's very sensual.
I don't know anything about the filters on what's going on, but there is, like, a mild, like, yellowish, light brownish haze that's like every time you see
that's
her,
just Bradley Cooper's looks, skin
that's true just reading that's true. Every time, like, it's like she's always slightly in the sun even if it's in 4 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that part and it should be emphasized that is the part where actual conversation and dialogue is happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was far and away the best part. The exact moment for me where it goes off the rails is I wish I could remember which Gaga performance, but there's some Gaga song where she's singing it and then sits down at a piano and sings the second half. Whenever that was, yeah. And then she goes full Gaga.
That's right before she's discovered by the manager character.
Right.
It's at that festival. And the song is called Always Remember Us This Way.
Yeah, let's listen to preferably the better part of this song so I don't have to PTSD on the worst part.
Letters on the sky, burning in your eyes. You look at me, babe, I want to catch on fire. It's buried in my soul, like California gold. You found the light in me that I couldn't find. So when I'm all choked up but I can't find the words, every time we say goodbye, baby, it hurts. When the sun goes down and the band won't play, this way. Lovers in the night, though it's trying to ride.
So for me, this is the moment where I don't know if Gaga forgets that she's playing a role. There's just, this is where the Gaga starts to emerge, and she's not Ally anymore, and she's a Gaga, even as she's becoming Ally, although really she's becoming Bebe Rexha. this is the part where things start to go wrong. Also, I feel like almost all the dialogue from this point forward is, number one, purely exists. Like, there's no kind of like development dialogue. It's all narrative furthering dialogue. And it's also awful, culminating in what to me is the worst scene, which is when she's in the bathtub.
Scene. The bathtub scene.
And Bradley Cooper is like, you can just bleep me for like 10 seconds straight. Cause well, it's just that, like,
all they, that's all they say at each other.
You fucking daddy.
He didn't tell her what he was going to say.
It was mean. It was legit mean.
It was mean.
Yeah, it's still also whack, mean and whack.
I thought he was going to kill her, despite knowing that wasn't actually going to happen.
Here's the twist. Even though the second half of the movie, really the second and third of the movie, were to me kind of like structural failures, I gave myself over to the kind of meta emotional content of the film. And even though I was watching it and laughing, and watching it and rolling my eyes, I was still watching.
You're still watching it.
I was still engaged. Whatever kind of like low sizzle thing Cooper is doing, still kind of held. Gaga's still was alert through the second.
Also,
part.
The house is so nice.
Yo, seriously.
But it wasn't Zillow. Too nice. I mean, at what point do we bring in the other movies? Because this is the class. This is like, you almost don't believe how small this house is.
Right.
Like, or like how modest it is.
So tasteful.
Yeah.
It's almost like an apartment.
Right.
It was like a tasteful apartment that happened to be a house. Okay, we have all given our opinions on the movie, but there is one opinion we have not gotten yet, and that is the official New York Times house opinion delivered by co-chief film critic Manola Dargis, who's calling in right now. Hi.
Hey.
Hi, Manola.
So,
Manola, we've all read your review, or at least everyone at this table has read your review. But for the people out there in podcast world who have not read it, tell them what the official NYT critic pick is.
It was a critic's pick. I like it very much. And in fact, I think certainly the first hour I love.
There we go.
I also think that it's a really perverse fantasy about men and women, and I didn't go into that into any great length because I also wanted people to discover it for themselves. But I do find it, I mean, it hews really closely to all the older movies. And I just think it's really fascinating as an object. But I really enjoyed it, too.
Tell us about that perverse fantasy about men and women, because we haven't really gotten into narrative stuff too deeply.
So how are we, like, spoilery? You know, are we?
Oh, just
we
no.
All spoilers.
All in.
It's the fifth, fourth version. People know.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, all
okay.
in.
So basically,
also, it's on the soundtrack, by the way.
Yeah. Okay. I just didn't know because, you know, I tread lightly when it comes to that.
Oh, yeah. No, we're in the deep end.
Okay.
Out of the shallow.
Oh.
Oh.
So, my dear listeners, he dies. And the reason
I wasn't really expecting that.
you may want to cut that out. I don't know.
No, we're keeping it. We're keeping it. If you're this far into this podcast and you don't know that that's the end, like, we can't help you at this point.
Also, it's going to be the number one album on Billboard next
week. Yeah, no, okay. We're good. Okay. We're good.
I was about ready for him to go. I got to be honest.
I take that personal. So what is interesting to me is that the very first version, which is actually called What Price Hollywood, is in 1932. And this is 2018. So for nearly, it's not really a century, but for a century of movie making, we have had this story that is reliably, you know, a tearjerker, and all the stories do really well. And they are the same exact story, really. A very successful man who is, you know, very vulnerable because he has, he's an alcoholic, finds a lovely young woman and they fall in love and he helps turn her into a star. But really for her to be completely, you know, to turn into the star that she was always meant to be, he must die. This is just some really bizarre Hollywood fantasy about male and female power. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about the latest iteration is that Bradley Cooper tells this story with such sincerity and apparently so little self-consciousness about how completely weird this story is. You know, I mean, it's just like I got enormous pleasure out of it just as a movie, but there was a part of my, you know, I'm just always a feminist. It's not like I turn my feminist brain on and off, but it's just going, holy hell, what is going on here? Like, wow, he is going for it. Yes, he's going to suffer, you know, and it's so grandiose. It's so ritualized, you know, what happens to him. And I think it's really fascinating. I think it's really fascinating given the given our current historical moment as well, given when we've kind of discovered just how terrible the abuse of women has been in even contemporary Hollywood.
I'm glad you brought that up because this idea that he does have to die in order for her, or that he has to disappear in order for her to thrive, of all the writers in Hollywood and all the studios in Hollywood, someone could make a film in which that does not, that the success of the woman is not predicated upon the death of the man.
And maybe one day when women actually have parity, that story will be told. But right now, this is
yay, Manola.
Right now, this is clearly the story that could be made, you know? And I think that that's really interesting. So again, I tried to kind of hint at what this other thing, but I also feel like I wasn't writing an essay, a larger essay. I wanted to review the movie, be true to what I thought, but also kind of just say, you know, there's something else going on here. And I
that's
think
what
it's
podcast is for. Podcast is for the essay.
Manola, do you not think that the movie takes away a little bit of her agency in, you know, how it portrays her quote unquote selling out?
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag, though. I mean, I don't ever see her as not having agency. And part of having agency is making bad mistakes, you know, and clearly the movie is on his side. You know, she's tacky. There's something really tacky about her.
Oh, that's so fascinating.
That's what I think. I mean,
oh, wow. I'd like to hear more about that. I'm not sure I experienced it that way.
Well, but Manola, I agree with you in that read, because there's a moment, and I don't know how to characterize this reaction, but this is what happened to me. The moment where I've been so dazzled and brainwashed by, I can't call them the movie's politics, although they are the movie's politics, that when she, and I so loved this woman as a character, and I believe in Jackson Maine's belief in what John got at today in his piece about authenticity and the singer-songwriter ethos as proof of authenticity, that when she gets to that SNL performance and she sings Why You...
Were you doing them jeans?
That
why did you do that?
I gasped. I was like, not my alley. My alley can't be doing that. Why is she talking like that? She's so trashy. I could not believe it.
Let's listen to that song about ass and denim, and that is called Why'd You Do That?
Why do you look so good in those jeans?
she aligns with the manager, her fate is sealed for a while.
Yep,
you know, that guy is a sleazebag, and we know he's a sleazebag because he doesn't wear socks with his shoes.
Yes, that is the number. That is
no, he does have socks on. They're just small socks.
They're called no-show socks.
He gave the appearance of having no-show socks.
It's even worse. It's vaping for feet.
Oh!
Wow.
They're
okay, listen.
Jackson wears freaking boots, man. He wears a man's boots.
He needs boots to crush up his pills. Socks.
That's true. But it's interesting, Manola, to hear you say that the movie kind of implicitly takes Jackson's side, because at almost no point in the film did I feel like Jackson was a triumphant character.
No, not triumphant, but pure.
Even it just seems so obviously a sham.
His morality, but not his... You know,
he's doing a conference for the Pharmaceutical Association or the Healthcare Association.
No, I'm sorry. No. I mean,
his skin is three different colors from being in the sun in weird times.
He is very much seen as someone who has, in some ways, surrendered, you know, to the kind of base, you know, capitalistic impulses of the movie. But his authenticity is part of there. I mean, where does the camera go? I mean, he's watching her on SNL. And he turns away from her, and we turn too. He is like, you know, it's so clear to me that he is so sensitive. I mean, this is such a male weepy. I mean, what's so interesting also about all these movies is that, no, it is. It's like these are classically women's pictures. Every single one of them, really, you can class as a women's picture. This movie turns into a male weepy. You know, it is very much about his emotional truth-telling to himself, reconciling with his brother, their terrible childhood, the whole backstory. I mean, part of that's just the therapeutic culture that we have that is really kind of, I think, really is damaging to movies, but just because it makes it really boring. And like, I can go to therapy myself, thank you very much. But it's, you know, there's an explanation for him versus the other movies, he's just an alcoholic and it's terrible and it's sad, you know? But here it's, you know, he has a backstory.
But just to dump on the one thing you said about, obviously, and this is something that comes up in those little videos that we do, like the narrating, anatomy of a scene.
Yeah.
So the anatomy of the scene that we ran for this movie is about the scene in the parking lot where Jackson Maine is observing Allie and seeing her as a star. And then Manola, you kind of you just talked about the kind of polar opposite or the reverse of that scene where instead of choosing to see her as a star, he turns away. So I understand from a narrative perspective how we are following the path of his relationship to like his belief in authenticity. But when he turned away at SNL, my immediate response was, this dude is trash.
I thought he couldn't deal with pop music. That pop music literally drove him to drink. He turns around from the pop music. He
and
grabs
I was like,
a beer.
This guy's trash.
Yeah.
And I was like, this guy's trash for this.
See, I've gone back and forth about this a lot. And I think ultimately what I've landed on is that the movie is not consistent with it, because I agree that at that point it's taking his side. He turns away. That's you hear that song. It's a pop song that's almost good as on its own as a pop song. Yep. But you can tell she held back a little bit, and the lyrics are so base that it's supposed to be stupid. But then in the bathtub scene, which we just discussed, when he says all the mean stuff about it, all of a sudden the vantage switches and you're like, wait, he shouldn't be saying that about this song. And then I feel like it takes her side again for a little bit. And then obviously he has to kill himself to get out of that. The musical politics of the movie, I think, ultimately are just not consistent. And I think that that's why it's so fun as a film, because you get to project sort of your own biases here. And that's why, John, when you saw him turn away from the ass song, you were like, you suck because you stand out here for the ass song.
But I don't
you know
think
what I mean? Like, professionally.
Also for my partner.
Whether or not her songs are good or not.
I don't see this as consistent. I think that this is what the movie is building to. You know, he sees her unadorned at the beginning, right? You know, first he sees her really with a mask on, right? Though with the little eyebrows and everything. Then, like, he takes her. I mean, I wrote some of this, but then, you know, he kind of then sees her all fresh faced, and we're like, oh, there she is. It's Allie. She's our fresh faced girl. And then she meets the sleazy manager, and she starts, like, everything changes, and she becomes this other creature for a while. And then she, you know, Jackson turns away, and then he's really mean to her. But it's all leading up to his spectacular death and her final triumphant when she can stand there with the legitimation of that last scene. Come on, you guys. It's just like, it's hilarious to me. I mean, I really enjoyed it, you know, very, very deeply.
Listening to you talk about it was for me a much more gratifying experience than watching it, honestly.
Super.
But it's like, I think it's interesting what you were saying about being about a male emotion. I'm sitting in a room of men who all seem to enjoy it, and I didn't derive any pleasure from it at all. I didn't feel bad when he died, and I cry at like dog commercials for dog food on TV.
I did not feel bad when he died. I mean,
As I said, I was ready for it.
Yeah. I mean, when he was murdered by the manager? That's what I'm saying. There's so many unsolved legal questions. Yes. No, first of all, that manager definitely murdered Jackson Maine.
Yeah.
He did. I mean, seriously, he does.
Manola, before you return to your glorious life in Los Angeles, are there any final thoughts you want to leave us with about this film or authenticity or perhaps Jackson Maine's hair?
You know, it's all good. I'm going to be revisiting all of the iterations, but I really do think that if you look at them, that they really say a lot about how the movie industry views relations between men and women. And I think it's really interesting that this is much more, even though, listen, as someone who basically reviews movies made by men for men, you know, the fact that a woman has any space in this movie is actually, and I mean this really sincerely, is actually kind of great. You know, I think she's wonderful in the movie, and I think the movie is really great until it isn't. And sometimes that's enough, and sometimes I just love stories about love. Sorry. Sorry.
Manola.
Karen Gans, you have to leave the podcast now. The energy's too good. Manola, thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you soon.
Okay,
bye, thanks. Manola.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks.
When we
bye.
Thanks.
Vows at the altar, I just didn't get to say everything that I wanted to say. So I wrote it down, and I brought it here. I hope it's okay if I love you forever, Jack.
Life is so simple. A little boy, a little girl, laughing and loving, trying to figure out the world. It felt like summer when I kissed you in the rain, and I know your story.
This is Sam Sifton, food editor of the New York Times. Whether you're just starting out in the kitchen or looking to up your game, NYT Cooking is here with more than 19,000 times-tested recipes and all the help you need to cook them well. Subscribe today at nytcooking.com/podcast.
Hey, this is Andrew Ross Sorkin from the New York Times. We're getting ready for the Big Deal Book Conference in New York City. This year it takes place on November 1st, and we're going to be talking about some of the biggest issues at the intersection of business and policy. We've assembled some of the brightest minds for one day all on the same stage. The CEOs of Google, Goldman Sachs, 21st Century Fox, Snapchat, General Motors, Merck, and so many more. I'm going to be asking some pretty tough questions about provocative issues and the hottest topics of the day. If you want to get in on it, you can check it out, nytdealbookconference.com. Hope to see you there.
I want to pile on to something Manola brought up, which is, why does Hollywood keep making this movie? I mean, it's always about the shy but extremely accomplished young woman who has to be convinced by the powerful and charisma-seeking guy to come out of her shell. But meanwhile, the woman has become Janet Gaynor, an accomplished actress. You know, she's become Barbara Streisand. She's become Lady Gaga. She's practiced the piano. She's learned how to sing. There's ambition there. There's artistry there. And why are they turning this down?
I have two words. Cardi B.
The next iteration?
As I was watching this movie, all I could think about was how much more I would enjoy this movie conceptually if it did not take this, as Manola points out, this tired male-female dynamic and instead was about the making of Cardi B. Maybe the male figure wouldn't be so tragic. Maybe there wouldn't even be a male figure.
Yeah, I don't think there would be.
No, but the idea, and we can talk a little bit about genre for a moment, the idea that, like, you have to, like, have this rough lump of coal named Allie, and we're going to, like, turn her into the diamond star. Like, that's not necessarily how it works. That's like a very 1960s or 1970s idea.
Well, this seems like a good idea to talk about what would have happened if it was Beyonce.
Well, I just want to do a fact check real quick, which is I think this is actually the fifth version of this movie. We're forgetting Country Strong, which Gwyneth Paltrow plays the Jackson Maine character.
Yeah. Jackson
they
Maine.
Did the gender flip.
Right.
And then there's a trio of people, and Leighton Meester plays
Garrett
Hedlund,
the extremely sexy Garrett Hedlund. And that is also, that is a movie made by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Shanna Feist is the director of that movie. That is the one of Gwyneth Paltrow's two or three best performances.
Amazing.
I am here as a person who believes that Gwyneth Paltrow is the best actress of her generation. No lies.
I'm with you.
And that is one of her, best. That movie is ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
But part of what's ridiculous about it is exactly what's ridiculous about this story. Except in some ways, it does kind of predict this moment in some weird way. And
the soundtrack is as good.
Yes.
I want to play a game real fast.
Okay.
Okay, everybody's going to have to write down or type in their phone the answer to this question.
Well, we don't have pens, John. So.
Okay. We didn't know. Bobcast budget does not budget for pens. So I need everybody to write down the answer. Here's a question. How old is Jackson Maine?
Ooh.
Write it down, then we're going to go around the table.
Obvious answer.
Okay. I'm going to start to my left, Karen Gans.
44.
Okay. John Perales.
I was going to be in the 45 range.
No. I need number. You 45?
Yeah, 45.
Okay. Wesley Marsh?
I wrote down Nosferatu.
The undead? Yeah. Okay. Joe Coscarelli?
I wrote down 50.
I wrote down 54. with the lower half of a 35-year-old.
Is there an answer?
I don't think there's an answer.
Okay. No answer.
But I spent a lot of the film completely vexed. I spent a lot of film vexed about Ali's genre confusion and a lot of film vexed about Jackson's age and like where in the pop music dialogue him and his music fits in. This actually came up in Taffy's piece about Bradley Cooper when they were editing that piece. Saya, one of our editors, said to me, like, oh, like, what kind of contemporary person do you think we could compare this person to? Because, like, we don't, you know, we can't figure it out.
I've been thinking about this a lot.
And I straight up could not come up with an answer. Sort of came up with, like, an Allman Brother or, like, a Bob Seger figure. Subsequent to that, I came up with a couple other ideas, like, sort of, like, cool guy Chris Stapleton, Ray LaMontagne on cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I sort of, like, I came up with a few other options. But the fact is, there is no actual real life precedent for the type of character that Jackson Maine is. There's also almost no precedent for like the intergenre relationship between a Jackson and an Ali type.
And the type of woman who could sing Shallow on a festival stage and then sing the ass song, as we're calling it on SNL.
Lady Gaga could
Lady
do
Gaga
that.
Is close.
Yes.
Okay. No, you know who's actually closest?
Don't say Bebe Rexha.
No. You know who's actually closest? Let's all look at Karen when we say this. Kelly Clarkson.
I was going to say Kelly Clarkson. No, I was going to say it.
Yeah.
Kelly Clarkson.
Kelly Clarkson was the closest I could come up with.
Okay, but I have a few thoughts. Well, factually, all right,
Will someone tell us how old Jackson Maine is, please? Is someone who works for the film,
It was not in the notes.
Factually, Bradley Cooper spent time with Eddie Vedder. That's in the press, which is interesting. You can see some of that in the character. He stole the You Stole My Voice thing from Bruce Springsteen's autobiography because Bruce said he stole his dad's voice. I've seen people mention dude from Kings of Leon, Caleb Falwell, is that his name? I don't know his name, which proves that he is not Jackson Maine. But ultimately, after days of sort of tossing this over in my head, I decided that I like that there is no real life parallel for him. A, because the Gaga real life parallel is so overwhelming in the film, and B, because it just adds to this idea that it's like a fantasy. You know, it exists. There are parts of it that are grounded in the real music industry, and then there are parts of it and parts of the plot that just make no sense. And I ultimately, as a film, I enjoy that.
I agree with that, although I was struggling the whole time to figure out who he was. I decided he was Dan Auerbach.
Again,
really?
A huge
very
compliment to Dan
very
Auerbach.
Yeah,
I was
going to
say, because guess what my pants aren't doing?
Oh!
No offense, but that's how good.
No, very much offense. Yeah. Okay, if you're playing at home and you'd like to decide what kind of musician Jackson Maine is, let's listen to a Jackson Maine original. And by original, I mean half written by Willie Nelson's kid. And that is Black Eyes.
Take this conversation that we're having about Jackson Maine, and I want to transpose it to Lady Gaga, because I actually think that one of the beautiful things about the first hour of this movie is that Bradley Cooper is looking at Lady Gaga, and I mean, this is the trope in all of the movies where the Svengali, for lack of a better term, removes the makeup or something of the ingenue at that moment. And what he does in that moment is also bring all of this Hollywood history into that moment and into every subsequent moment in which he expresses a belief in the star that she can be. I thought about Liza Minnelli. I thought about Streisand. I thought about Cher. The weird thing about this movie to me is that watching it and trying to figure out what is going on in it reminds me of my experiences going to the opera. And you go to these operas and the plots make no sense. They make no sense. You're at La Boheme, and if you go with a very smart person who can read it for you, they can make it make sense. But or Così fan tutti, like all of these operas, none of them make any sense.
As a cultural savage, like, I have no idea. Is that true?
Is Born is basically it's Verdi, right? It is an opera where the things that we're talking about, in some ways, the mechanical vehicle for people to do things that we paid money to see them do, is secondary to what we paid to see them do. And so you have this platform on which Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper do what they do. And their motivations for doing it are either contradictory, illogical, incoherent, something. And you can't diagram this sentence, so to speak.
Okay.
But the words are great and they look nice and cursive. I've gone off the deep end with this metaphor.
Way off.
But you know what I mean? Like, I like trying to figure out what really is going on in terms of, because it doesn't work as a music industry movie. It's almost better if it had just been a movie about acting.
Except, it used to be.
Right. Yeah. But the reason I think it shifted to music and musicals was the only way to prove to an audience that somebody is talented truly is to have them sing.
Perform, yeah.
Right.
Okay, but it's interesting because I think what you're saying ties back into something we were talking about earlier, which is this movie works in almost a rhythmic and impressionistic way. It hits the beats that we have been trained to expect in order to trigger the set of feelings that we associate with big cinema, capital C. But what's happening underneath, what's like the nature of the smudging is, who knows?
Well, that's what Wesley's saying about opera. You go to the opera for the emotional sweep and to be taken away by the music and, soup zone of tragedy on top. Mm-hmm. I mean, but you want the surge more than you're going to put together the logic.
I want to return to this, you know, the current erotism that flows through this movie. In as much as something can be coherent about an argument being made about what real self-expression is, can you just sort of basically re-articulate your argument against the position this movie kind of takes?
Well, I mean, the movie posits Jackson Maine as a truth seeker. Even if he's drunk and playing corporate shows and whatever, he can see it in others. He finds it in Allie. It's like, you can deliver the truth, even though the first time he sees her, she's in reverse drag. But he perceives her truth. He unveils her. He may not be able to do it himself anymore until her good influence changes him, but he can perceive the truth, and which is fine with me. You can, I mean, La Vie en Rose, lots of artifice, lots of truth. But then the movie makes the argument that truth is guitars and real voices, and that's pretty much it, I think.
Barf!
Power ballads.
Well, it's interesting because, yeah, when Allie is sort of redeemed as a musician, right, she starts very pure. The eyebrows come off. She's extra pure. Then she's bad when she's on SNL or...
And then she gets the Grammy for it, which is a little twist.
She gets the Grammy for it. And then she's...
So the Grammys have gotten more progressive?
She returns to purity when she sits down at a piano, basically. When she sings a piano ballad, right? When she sings the song that he left for her. And it's interesting...
I thought you meant when he died.
Well, basically. When he dies.
Ultimately.
But it's interesting because, and Karen, I know you've been itching to talk about this, that's also a move that Lady Gaga made in her career, which was... I was authentic when I was playing on the Lower East Side. Then I did the high pop thing. And then I sat back down at a piano and I made Joanne.
Yeah, not even a piano. It's like the most stripped back she could possibly be. It's acoustic guitars all over Joanne.
I'm thinking of A Million Reasons.
Oh, A Million Reasons. Yeah, yeah. People are just not talking about this a lot, and it's very frustrating to me, and I don't think any of the interviews really have gotten her to talk about it the way that her career maps onto the movie. Like, she seems to have gotten away with murder and not having to talk about it. Mm-hmm. She is literally a pop star who has gone through every phase that the character in the movie goes through.
Let me ask you this question, though. Do you feel that the Allie character is a rebuke of High Point Gaga?
In a way, yes.
Yes.
But and that depresses me because I feel like she'll never get back there. I think Joanne is terrible. I don't think that this is an opinion that everybody didn't know I held.
I think this is not a rare opinion.
And I loved Lady Gaga so much. And I really feel like I was prepared to hate Born This Way. And then I think it's her best work. I really, the whole album, with minus Judas and that song. But Joanne irked me so much because she seemed to be projecting this message, which was everything I did before was artifice. I've dug into my family's history and I found a story.
And
of
I put
woe.
On a cowboy hat.
Yeah. But like, you know, this is the authentic story. This is the story that impacted my family's lives. But, you know, the sound of the album, the story of it, everything about it had to be pure and rock. You know, she worked with Mark Ronson and they had sessions.
Who also worked on this soundtrack.
Yes. Co-wrote Shallow, which hopefully we get to at some point. It's killing us over here,
the
guys.
My God. But do you take Why Did You Do That to be her saying Just Dance was never any good?
I don't know. I can't decide.
I feel like it's... Yeah. Okay.
Wesley, go in.
I do... I am 100% with you in that reading, and it really... I was so under this movie's spell that when you get to the SNL moment, I was two people. I was the person enjoying this movie and believing what Jackson believes about that moment when he turns his back on the monitor. But I also was like, but wait a minute. This is what she does. Like, why did you do that? That's like Lady Gaga. I mean, but, yes. We've established yes.
It's like bad Lady
but,
Gaga.
Right. Yes, but...
So it's interesting to try to do as a project to displace this... fictional characters' choices onto Lady Gaga. I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to do.
Yeah.
But I think that there is... Okay, so I'm not to interrupt, but I do think that there is a subtlety that we are overlooking, which is in the film, there are actually at least two distinct Allie phases, like peak pop Allie phase. There's bad SNL, and then there's I dyed my hair red and took control. There is this...
He told her to dye her hair.
Yeah, yeah.
He said to dye her hair blonde. not to dye her hair. Like it
it's
was
like a com- so it was
there,
a
there's
compromise.
A point
she
in the movie.
But the point is that she pushed back against what the sleazy manager said
and did and half of what he asked you to do.
But that was, but still, but it was. I meant it was a it was symbolic of her still having some sense of agency.
See, now, that's the other thing. Right here.
I was gonna say I disagree with everybody. Manola said this too. I didn't feel like she had any agency at all the entire movie. I felt like she was just tossed about. The entire time, you know, he decides, he finds her and decides, okay, you can be a star. She was struggling beforehand with absolutely no success. And then the manager takes over and he decides you're going to do this, you're going to do that. I didn't really find a moment of agency in the entire thing.
Well, her career as Ally is super compressed, right? Yes. I've seen people do the sort of fact check that says, like, you know, the Grammys and the SNL season finale are 9-10 months apart. Yeah. And in the movie, it's 9 or 10 minutes. John, I think it almost gets there, but it's unclear if she really has more agency Ally because she doesn't perform.
Here's the bigger question. Fair. Is the only way to write a sincere from the heart pop song to write a power ballad?
Yes, exactly.
I think you're kind of limiting your options here.
That is what makes me crazy. And like before, who
did Cardi B.
Well, no, did you compare her to BB Rexha or Rita Ora?
BB Rexha. John.
Sorry.
Karamonic.
That's
That's the kind of pop star she's portraying, though. She's not portraying, in that sense, she's not portraying a Gaga-esque pop star, which is like in the class of Madonna, like the real shapeshifters with the, like, you know, the kind of pure talent to actually make, you know, to change pop history.
All my Rexars and bad.
I don't think you're supposed to believe that about Ally.
But, and yet, when they talk about the writing of the movie, obviously Lady Gaga is not a writer of the film, but Bradley Cooper says he interviewed her about her career and that he took her arc, basically. So it's hard to, and I haven't seen her speak openly about which parts of the Ally character she relates to and which parts are just the movie. I would love to hear that.
Can I ask a sort of larger political question? Because we're sitting here talking about this and I'm thinking about this in a way that I hadn't previously thought about it before. I mean, I hadn't processed it. Like, these movies are all predicated upon a woman sort of proving, well, let me think about exactly how to say this. Because the problem with these movies is you kind of have to believe we're talking about discovering a woman and making her a star. But in all of these movies, in every single one, the first time we see the woman perform,
what's
the number one question you're asking? Why isn't this woman already famous?
She's already good.
Judy Garland, when she saves James Mason's ass in her opening number in the 54 version, you watch her and you're like, well, why isn't she just starring in the whole show? What's with the big band and the dancers and stuff? And she sings "The Man Who Got Away" at a piano, like they're rehearsing in some bar somewhere, and he soberly wanders in and quote discovers her unquote. But she like sings the shit out of "The Man Who Got Away."
Well, that is the best song in any of the cycle.
Extremely bleak.
Right?
Wait, can we listen to it?
Let's talk about the show. Let's talk about
Judy Garland, "The Man Who Got Away."
Let's listen to that.
The winds grow colder. Suddenly, you're older. And all because of the man that got away. No more his eager call. The writing's on the wall. The dreams you've dreamed have all gone astray. The man that won you has run off and undone you. That great beginning has seen a final inning. Don't know what happened. It's all a crazy game.
I'm just raising this because the what we're calling is a weird power imbalance balance, right?
Oh, it's so strange. I don't feel this way.
No, but let me finish. I might be where you are.
Yeah.
But what's interesting to me is the corollary question to why isn't this person already famous is why the this guy famous? Mm-hmm. What? I mean, and Bradley Cooper gives a very, very good performance in this movie. It's not a question of like Bradley Cooper selling you on the fame of this man, but part of the reason that we can't figure out who his real life corollary is because this person would never be famous under any circumstances. We never see him at his peak. We never see James Mason in the 54 version at his peak. Kris Kristofferson, he's at his peak in that movie, but he's still Kris Kristofferson. And when he sings Evergreen with Barbara, I almost said Barbara Walters.
Imagine.
That was a fire version, yeah.
When he sings Evergreen in the studio, in the 76 version with Barbara Streisand in the studio.
You want the hook.
He first of all, yes. And second, he looks like, why did I agree to do this? Listen to, he's in awe and embarrassed.
But to that point, though, the way the film treats Jackson Maine, the way the film treats Allie is very different cinematically.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that you learn about Jackson in terms of his alleged fame or alleged success is almost all through proxy moments. It's through how people react to him.
Yes.
It's the guy in the bar who wants the photo because someone who looked like him slept with his sister or girlfriend or something. It's the woman at the store sneaking a photo of. It's him showing up at a drag bar that seemed to be in like central Queens and still everybody knows who he is, even though it's not his normal haunt on a Friday night. Whereas everything that you learn about Allie's character and is trying to convince you that she's talented or gifted is all about her performance. It's all about what she's giving to the movie.
Right. But this
and
is
that's
true.
Very different.
This is
film.
True in all of them. And but to your point, though, I feel like there's a kind of entitled, there's a woman has to work, man entitled to. We don't see the men do any of the work.
Because we're meeting them post-peak, as you say. We're meeting them, we're supposed to, it's a changing of the guard, and that's where the movie starts. And I'm fine with
it. I'm just raising this. There is a heavy lift that the woman has to do in this fantasy. And we as participants take for granted the greatness of the man because other people tell us it. But would we believe that James Mason is this great actor if we saw him act near Judy Garland? We can see Kris Kristofferson doing his peak Kristofferson thing opposite one of the three or four greatest voices in the history of American recorded music.
Mm-hmm. Lady Gaga.
Bibi Rexha.
And it's just a really interesting, it's an interesting problem that is never problematized in these movies.
But to circle back to where you started this about how Gaga is already good, Allie is already good, in a weird way, during that parking lot scene where she's so obviously great, from a narrative perspective, I was like, we're a little early in the movie for her to be this great. Mm. Like, I actually had a
different
response
to it. She's just
going
off the top writing a song about his biography.
Yeah, were moments that I was like, this is too much.
I actually believe that there are people who've just been waiting. I do believe that, this is the
been
best.
Been waiting to get pulled on stage.
This is
besides Young Thug, name one.
But I do think this is, of these versions, I think this is the most convincing one. She seems older. I mean, all of the women who've played this part have been in their 30s or older. Now, they've all been in their 30s. But this one, I felt like I understood why she wasn't more famous. I understood why this drag bar, for instance, would keep letting her sing her songs because they all know she's amazing. but would she not be on YouTube? Would there not be a channel?
She gets famous via YouTube.
Which is hilarious.
But it is also the only moment in the movie where social media plays a role.
Because also post-Grammys when the manager is she's getting killed for this, basically, after he pees himself.
Yeah,
that,
but
that
that's
has
not
social media
it's implicit, but it's not. But also, you saw it's spoiler also that's alert. a network broadcast television show. You would think this kind of story in 2018, if it's not about Cardi B, it's about a YouTube star.
But again, this movie is out of time.
It's still in time and out of time.
Yeah, right. It's basically still in the 70s.
She talks about
that she
writing
goes
songs
viral.
On a typewriter.
Yes.
I like to write on a typewriter, she says. And they show his stereo equipment on the shelf, which is like Akai Marantz. And, He's got vinyl that he gives to her father. It's all analog. You know, analog is good. You know, modern also, digital is fake and bad.
And also, one more way that this movie is set in the 70s is that every famous musician is white.
Well, this brings me, I really want to...
We have to talk about race in
this movie. I want to explore the Cardi B question, because the one thing that keeps this story from seeing... I mean, listen, we like the people who love this movie love it, and... I do wonder, because I didn't watch it thinking, I didn't have any whataboutism watching the movie, but I do think that I think it becomes less like an opera story and more like something like life, less like a fantasy. If you just make the girl black, make her from the DR, make her something that doesn't, for which there is no ready corollary, or where the channel to her being famous and successful is way more difficult than it would be for Lady Gaga,
right.
For Ali.
So that's Beyonce, right? This movie at one point was supposed to star Beyonce.
Yes, it was.
What kind of film would that have been?
It's a great question.
Could you suspend disbelief?
No.
With Beyonce?
Yeah, I mean, well, could Beyonce be
no,
Mousy
in
2018?
No.
It would, it would require, the thing that's so good about that first hour is Lady Gaga is giving a performance. She is playing a regular person with a regular life.
Allegedly.
That grates.
Yeah. Wait, should we squeeze a donut on your face?
I did not like that. That was my least favorite part of the movie.
That was a very strange,
but it's got this.
I don't know whose fetish that was, but that is not a cool
fetish.
Yeah,
it's interesting. It's questionable.
But back to Beyonce.
But it's got this great opening where she is breaking up with this guy in a bathroom stall.
Roger.
It's very like, you were working as a waitress at a cocktail bar,
yes,
when I met you. And I love that that's what she's acting, right? She's acting living in that house with Andrew Dice Clay, mm-hmm, and these men in it all the time with their little, like, they're not creepy, but they're not entirely supportive of her. She has a, like... The things that they're acting in the first hour are really interesting to me as character development challenges. The challenge for Beyonce in this part would be to go small.
Would be to be normal.
She'd have to be just some person.
There's no way. I think there's no way.
But
I think 4 years ago there's a way?
Yeah, pre-Lemonade, I think that there was a way. I think that she became a different person, mm-hmm, post-Lemonade.
I think that's,
I think, like,
right,
a Jennifer Hudson Dreamgirls era could have pulled this off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think who else.
But see, I think this should be a challenge that she tries. Because, you know, the thing about The Bodyguard, for instance, is nobody would have believed that Whitney Houston
could have done that.
Could have done it. And that movie is R-rated. It is raunchy. Whitney has a foul mouth. And she's got a libido. And
but
that
was the real Whitney.
Right. But we didn't know that in 1992.
But also that movie, right? Whitney didn't have to be small in that role.
Like, no.
She didn't have to, that movie didn't necessitate someone who could shrink herself.
But she had to be not Whitney.
But she had to not.
But there's a difference between being not Whitney but still being a Whitney-esque figure and being someone who is basically pre-Whitney. And Gaga, I think Gaga has cycled through so many phases of career that she actually has gotten to the point where she has stripped away a bunch of the stuff from 5 to 7 years ago.
And she is a shapeshifter in a way that Beyonce is not. Yeah.
But I think Beyonce, I just, there's no reason. I'm with you guys. I would have to see it to believe it, but I want to see it enough to try to believe it.
You also, you know what the black version of this is Beyond the Lights.
Yeah, I was going to say it.
Which has the same problems with authenticity, right. Yep. Where she's only good when she's not Rihanna, she's India Ari.
Yeah.
Oh,
she cuts her hair. It's true.
Everybody watch Beyond the Lights.
Country Strong and Beyond the Lights, two movies to add to the Star is Born.
Yeah, the curriculum. Yeah.
Building on this, though, can we talk about how non-white characters are used in this film, and I say the word used very deliberately,
mm-hmm,
because I feel like they come up in a few different circumstances. Number one, when Jackson first goes to the drag bar, he is brought in by Ali's friend, who's played by Anthony Ramos.
Mm-hmm. Does he have a name Hamilton, in the movie?
He's so fame. Charismatic.
He's very good in Hamilton.
Yeah.
I thought he was great in
the minor characters.
But didn't get a great character.
Doesn't get much character, but basically his job is to facilitate. So it's basically like exposing the white rocker dude to the world of drag and to the world of Ali. There's that. There's the Dave Chappelle character, who's like, baffling. I guess, like an AA sponsor.
He's supposed to be a childhood friend.
Okay.
Cool. But yeah, not fleshed out.
Right. And then Eddie Griffin shows up and marries them in a black church out of nowhere.
Some nice suits in that scene.
There are some okay suits. That's true. I guess I just found myself vexed at every turn by a film that posits that all pop music is a war between rootsy white music and thin electronic white music, that basically all the non-white characters are basically there in like the purest of functional helper roles, and that there's no sense basically of blackness in popular music.
Just the fake Quavo at the Grammys.
Yeah, just yes.
Yeah, but you know,
and that really, I found that really like, and you want to talk about suspending disbelief about all the film's relationship to what's actually happening in pop music. That was something that I found incredibly hard. Ali's career, even when Ali was at her most pop, was curiously deracinated pop. That's how it felt to me.
And
in a film in which they're trying to avoid race at every turn.
I agree with that read.
It's
funny,
a read.
I definitely felt like the appearance of Dave Chappelle. You know, so one of us said at some point that this probably, you know, the Judy Garland James Mason version is nearly 3 hours. The Barbara Streisand Kris Kristofferson version is 2 hours and 20 minutes.
This one's nearly 6 hours. But
Is there a version in which that relationship is fleshed out in a different way? I felt like, you know, as a person who has been like asking this very question like his entire adult life, I simultaneously accept it as a convention, but also really do wonder what the conversations were like. You've got two very good comedians not playing comedians. They're
not really doing much of anything.
Facilitating. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It does not sink the movie for me at all, but it does. I don't know. I don't know what to do with it. I don't have anything sophisticated to say about it. It is a question worth asking and a problem that can't be solved. And it's like an inherited, because these aren't problems in the Streisand version, for instance, right? In the Garland version, the black people don't exist. but in the Streisand version, she's in a group called, when we meet her, she's in a group called the Oreos.
Her co-singers are
Vanetta Fields and Clydie King.
Yeah, she's the white singer between the two black singers.
Yes.
The Oreos.
Yes. And
John's going to pass out.
So at least they didn't bring that part back.
But what's interesting about that version, JP, is that Barbara Streisand, when she's with them, is conjoined to them. She won't let them. You know, the read on Barbara Streisand's like selfishness and vanity is so messed up. You know, the controversy over
in
this
the
movie
film
is
or in real life?
In real life, in relation to the movies and her how she's self-depicted. You know, she allegedly had a hand in making that Star Is Born. And I feel like she was kind of beat up. This movie was a huge hit in 1976. Huge, 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 huge. Third biggest movie of 76. And it is explicitly feminist. There's one little tiny weird, I can't believe she did that thing. But she is insistent on all of these equalizations. They literally build a house in the desert together with their own two hands. Together they build this house. But whenever she's photographed, whenever she's filmed, the framing in the studio when the two singers are around, she is with them and she keeps them in the shot. The only time in the movie where she's singing with them and that isn't true is the final sequence, which
If nobody's seen the end of the 76 version of A Star Is Born, the reason to have paid what probably would have been $2.50 at the time, or $1.50, is for that ending. That is the, it's funky and, you know, disco, that all the 70s, like, pre-disco-ishness creeps into the song. But it is Barbra Streisand's, one of her greatest singing performances. John, do you, am I crazy?
No, you're not crazy.
Leave a troubled past and I might start. I'll solve the mysteries if you're the prize. Refresh this tired eyes with one more look at you. Overcome the anger that I've learned to know.
The other thing about that movie is that's the one where she doesn't proclaim her husband's last name.
Yes, yes.
And this one goes back to it. I am Allie Mayne at the end.
Yes. And also in that final performance, she's Allie Mayne and also apparently half Whitney Houston. That is actually,
I said Celine.
Oh, no. I think
Celine. I see it.
Oh, I felt like there was like a flicker of I have nothing in there, like in sort of the phrasing.
Smallest of flickers.
Yeah, very small. But I do think some of the sort of vowel, like the way that she's sort of grappling with vowels in that performance remind me very much.
On the soundtrack, it sounds like Celine.
Let's agree that that is not the best performance of the film. So that we can listen to Shallow.
Here's the thing. As we leave this episode, should we all stand up and sing the chorus of Shallow?
Absolutely not.
I'm lip syncing.
Wait, do we have a, what do I have?
Baydra says yes, please.
If we can sing to track.
No.
Wesley?
No.
You've been voted down.
I loved the scene where she just suddenly pops on stage and knows the whole song. He's like, oh, I've met you once.
Well, he's arranged it.
Well, I met you once 24 hours
and
ago.
He wrote new lyrics.
But I somehow taught the entire band the song. And I mean, like, that's an insane suspension of disbelief.
This is when you're accepting it as a musical. Like, and I mean, really,
yes, yeah. Yeah. And so I obviously, like, did not accept it as a musical.
But her covering her eyes before she gets to the...
Yes, that's great.
I mean,
it just... There's so many wonderful things about that performance in the first hour that just, like, bring tears to my eyes when she socks that cop. Like,
that's great.
Just, like, all of these little, you know, I can just imagine, you know, there's a reason that we're on a tangent, but, like, there's a reason that Cher was a really good movie star, and it's because she never sang in the movies. And I think it gave her an opportunity to figure out how to exist away from music. Now, you know, this is a thing that like haunted Judy Garland she was never really allowed to not sing. And it was a thing that Whitney Houston would never really have been able to get away with for much longer.
I think Gaga, well, she's already won a Golden Globe without singing, but I think Gaga will be allowed to act without singing
I really want to see how that goes.
No, I do too. I feel like the hater, so I have to say again, I liked Lady Gaga in the movie. I thought she was great. Okay, so now can we finally listen to Shallow? Everybody, just please say that we can.
Of course.
Yes. Okay, thank God.
This is Shallow by Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper.
Tell me something, girl. Are you happy in this modern world? Or do you need more? Is there something else you're searching for? I'll fall in all the good times. I find myself longing for change, and in the bad times I fear myself.
That is our show, our rowdy show. It has been hard being this hardcore, but we do it for you every week. First of all, thanks to my guests, Karen Gans, John Pareles, Wesley Morris, Joe Coscarelli, on the phone, Manola Dargis. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us. I'm sure there are some contrarian takes out there about A Star Is Born, Karen Gantz. So feel free to email them to us at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week. Myself longing for change. And in the bad times, I fear myself.